The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, December 14th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Is Russia friend or foe? Is Syria burning? And can anything be done about it? And is there anything to be read into the announcement that former Texas Governor Rick Perry is Donald Trump's choice to lead the Energy Department? Once upon a time, candidate Perry couldn't remember the name of the agency he will now lead. You may remember that from 2011.
Oops.
He has said he would eliminate the Department of Energy, but its jobs are pretty important, if not terribly glamorous. DOE maintains and oversees nuclear safety, both in weapons programs and in power production. Is the Trump administration pro-nuclear to the extent that we can expect aggressive new building programs to take advantage of nuclear's carbon-free, emission-free qualities? In a questionnaire sent to the Department of Energy, the Trump team indicated they were interested in preventing the shutdown of nuclear power plants. They also asked for the names of employees and contractors who have attended UN climate meetings, as well as those who helped develop President Obama's social cost of carbon metrics. The DOE has since denied the Trump team's request for that list of climate change staffers. Would Perry oversee a DOE purge, or is the Department of Energy more of a backwater today and Perry's appointment less than meets the eye? Gregory Yatsko was the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which works closely with the Department of Energy on nuclear issues between 2009 and 2012.
Well, right now, nuclear is really facing a lot of headwinds. It's very expensive. It's being challenged by technologies that don't emit carbon, like renewables that are getting cheaper, by natural gas, which is extremely cheap. And so really for nuclear to survive, it probably needs a heavy dose of some kind of government subsidy. And those subsidies ultimately are going to have to come from the Department of Energy, from in some cases from the states. So I think if you're really committed to trying to revive the nuclear in this country, it means you probably can't eliminate the Department of Energy. There's certainly an argument that says that let the market decide. And if you let the market decide, then nuclear probably doesn't have a very long future.
And so if you appoint someone from an oil-producing state like Texas to head the Department of Energy, which is overseeing safety in the nuclear industry, you might conclude that, in fact, nuclear is on the way out.
Certainly, Texas has, and the governor of Texas has a strong interest in oil and gas, I would assume. And the president-elect, Donald Trump, has also indicated strongly that he wants to revive the coal and the natural gas industries, all of which, if you do, really undercuts one of the benefits that nuclear industry likes to claim, which is that it provides this kind of steady state power as opposed to the more intermittent power that comes from renewables. But if you really put a lot of emphasis in these oil and fossil industries, then it does really undermine and probably, again, put you more in line of thinking that the nuclear industry really doesn't have a tremendous future in the long term.
And so if you appoint someone from an oil-producing state like Texas to head the Department of Energy, which is overseeing safety in the nuclear industry, you might conclude that, in fact, nuclear is on the way out.
Well, I think certainly Texas has, and the governor of Texas has a strong interest in oil and gas, I would assume. And the president-elect, Donald Trump, has also indicated strongly that he wants to revive the coal and the natural gas industries, all of which, if you do, really undercuts one of the benefits that nuclear industry likes to claim, which is that it provides this kind of steady state power as opposed to the more intermittent power that comes from renewables. But if you really put a lot of emphasis in these oil and fossil industries, then it does really undermine and probably, again, put you more in line of thinking that the nuclear industry really doesn't have a tremendous future in the long term.
Well, just thinking about Donald Trump's tweets on the F-35 fighter program, where he wants to bring the costs down of this very expensive Pentagon program. I mean, does that argue for a Rick Perry being an aggressive sort of critic of the nuclear industry and these plants that are being built to try to get them under budget? Is there a way to do that without, passing new legislation, but basically being more aggressive in oversight?
Well, in a lot of ways, that oversight happens at the state level. But I think certainly where the president can have a role, and where the president, this president seems to, or president-elect seems to want to have a role, is through the Twitter, his Twitter account. And certainly, if he's concerned about cost overruns on the F-35 program, the cost overruns at the Vogtle and the summer plants in Georgia and South Carolina are pretty extensive. And right now, the federal taxpayer is on the hook for a lot of those cost overruns if the plants are never built, because the major incentive program that was passed in 2005 was a loan guarantee program. So all the loans that have gone to those projects from Wall Street, from other large financial institutions, are backed by the U.S. government. So if those projects ultimately fail to become operational, then the U.S. taxpayer is on the hook to essentially pay back those loans to large financial institutions. So, if President-elect is concerned about those kinds of things, which he seems to have an inclination to show, then I think that might be a project he'd want to take a look at.
So if he's paying attention, how many billions are we talking about with these plans?
Several billions. The exact number is a little difficult to pin down, but it's in on the order of billions. For a project that originally started out, it was expected to cost about $5 billion or so a reactor. That number has gone up by several billion dollars each reactor. And again, they're almost doubling the projected construction schedule. So it just leads to a conclusion that it's very, very difficult to build new reactors in this country, which, again, if you go back to the question of whether the government will do a lot to stimulate nuclear, at some point there's very little that you can do when the industry itself is having so much trouble with actually building the new plants that they want to build.
Well, if the president-elect is listening, maybe we'll get a tweet out of this discussion about those plants. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Good to talk to you, John.
Gregory Yochko is the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who works closely with the Department of Energy on nuclear issues between 2009 and 2012. At any given moment, U.S. military personnel command an arsenal of nuclear weapons that could seriously, speed up climate change at the very least. The urgency of that responsibility is partially why 60% of the Energy Department's budget goes toward managing the National Nuclear Security Administration. In this century, counterterrorism and nonproliferation are added worries in a world that still holds thousands of nuclear weapons. The oversight on these very serious questions of nuclear security are the responsibility of an international agency, though. The UN Security Council's Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization enforces a treaty of the same name which bans nuclear explosions anywhere on Earth, in the atmosphere, underwater, and underground. To enforce that ban, it has to be able to detect them. And Lacina Zerbo is executive secretary of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization and proudly says his agency knows within minutes whether a country like North Korea has detonated a nuclear device.
We see the whole world. We have 337 facilities that are distributed, including detectors and laboratories that cover the world in an homogeneous manner, so that wherever you are on the planet, the detection is done the same way, by triangulation, meaning three stations will contribute to verify and to confirm one detection.
When you get a suspicious event, what do you call it until you know that it's probably a nuclear test?
Yeah, first, it's a suspicious event. Second is to know that if this event is man-made and not just a mix of an earthquake that wasn't properly detected. And then the last will look for the smoking gun that will give the nuclear nature of the seismic event that is detected.
Have you ever been there in the middle of the action when a test was conducted and you were trying to figure it out?
Of course. First, I was the director of the International Data Center, so that was my role. And now as executive secretary, I have staff and experts who are working. What happened when it's happened at 2:30 in the morning, I'm called maybe the next 10 minutes to be part of the action and then to follow the process until we bring the information to our member states. And this is what we do. And then we've been doing this since 2006 within the framework after entering into force of the treaty. So meaning we're basically serving the international community today as if the treaty is into force. And nobody complains about it because they're happy to get the information.
Is it noisy when that happens? I've seen too many movies, of course. are people running around sharing data, calling out commands?
Yeah, it's you have a situation room where you know it's a crisis management, so we'll be sitting there, and then we'll have analysts looking at the data regularly, and then you know, a progressive way they tell us more information. We're getting close to a man-made event, and then until we say yes, indeed, it's a man-made event, and then we're waiting for the smoking gun, and this is where we are right now.
How has the technology of nuclear testing changed, and does it benefit the ability to detect what's going on in North Korea?
Absolutely. I think right now we've built an international monitoring system that serves as one of the strongest deterrent to any hidden nuclear test explosion, including North Korea, by the way, because we've been detecting in an efficient and reliable manner all nuclear NOS tests by the DPRK.
So is it the case that every nuclear explosion has a particular nucleotide identity?
I wouldn't go as far as saying this because our job is to detect any of them, and then we're geared for that. But depending on whether you have an underground explosion or an atmospheric explosion, you can talk about detecting particulate in the atmosphere or xenon gases that will emanate from the cracks through the ground.
And it's like a fingerprint or just an indication that it's been a nuclear test?
It will be a fingerprint when you detect those, because what we do, we correlate those detections for wherever we find them through our station to an event. And then we leave it to our state signatories, the responsibility to merge it with their national technical means and then give the conclusion whether it's a nuclear test explosion or not.
So how did your organization roll into action?
So I think things have evolved. Let me put it this way, because for the past 20 years, we moved from a situation where we were pretty passive due to the fact that the treaty that we serve is yet to enter into force, to a more proactive role thanks to you, the media, because you demand more, you want more information, and we cannot evolve without giving to the civil society, to the international community, the information they need. So now our job during the last test was 6 minutes after the event, we were and we remain the only institution to have given the information to all our state signatories.
All right. Lesina Zerbo, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
So nice to talk to you.
Nice talking to you, too.
Lesina Zerbo is Executive Secretary of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The future of U.S.-Russian relations with each day looks more confused and conflicted, with the destruction of Aleppo, Syria, and Russian air power helping to hand that city back to Syrian government control. There is yet another issue on which the U.S. and Russia seem to be at odds. It's becoming clear that Russian cyber espionage has had some impact on the U.S. election. The extent to which Russian information warfare has disrupted the 2016 election is unprecedented by a foreign power, according to security sources, sticking by their story, despite Trump dismissals this week. And so right off the bat, even before the inauguration, there is bipartisan support on Capitol Hill of an investigation into the alleged Russian hacking. Unease over the future Trump administration's relationship with Russia and Vladimir Putin has only been exacerbated this week by the appointment of Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, a man with billions at stake over sanctions on Russia's oil assets. Maryland Senator Ben Cardin is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he says there's no reconciling recent Russian moves as the actions of an ally.
They're certainly not our friend. They certainly have done things that you would consider to be an enemy. When you attack a country, you're an enemy, and they attacked us through the use of cyber. They try to interfere with our elections. They certainly have been counter to us in regards to what they're doing in Europe and in what they're doing in the Middle East.
Do you believe that Donald Trump has creditors inside of Russia?
No, I'm not. I don't want to draw that conclusion. I think that what we need to do is understand what the intentions of Russia. Clearly, Donald Trump has his own agenda, his own reasons for what he does and what he states. But it is of concern as to what Russia's intentions are in regards to the United States.
Well, let's just look at it from Russia's perspective. I mean, you've got Hillary Clinton and the continuation of the Obama administration, which is essentially a policy of confrontation on matters of NATO and the Baltic states and more war games in Europe and in Eastern Europe versus somebody who is a wild card on all of these questions, has said complimentary things about you, and in many ways is someone who does business in Russia. It's kind of a no-brainer. It seems to me that Vladimir Putin would obviously prefer Trump over Clinton.
Well, I'm not prepared to draw that conclusion. I think that's one of the areas that I would like to see part of an independent investigation. What we do know is that Donald Trump has business interests in Russia. We know many of the people he is selecting to be his close advisors or part of his cabinet have business connections in Russia. We want to make sure that those that are in positions of trust, including the President of the United States, that their decisions are based solely on what's in the best interest of the United States. So it's critically important for Mr. Trump to divest himself of any potential conflict, but it's equally important that whoever he selects in top positions, including Secretary of State or any advisors, that their interests are going to be first with the United States.
Well, since you mentioned Secretary of State, what do you think of Tillerson having a $500 billion deal in the Arctic with Russia right now that's under sanction?
I think in Mr. Tillerson's case, the confirmation hearings are going to be absolutely critically important as to whether he should be confirmed or not as Secretary of State. We need to understand what he's doing with his financial interests. We need to know what the statements he has made historically concerning Russia and sanctions, whether that was just as a result of being CEO of Exxon or whether that was his own personal beliefs. There's a lot of questions that need to be asked, and we got to get straight answers.
With its veto in the Security Council and support for Bashar al-Assad in Syria, do you consider that Russian air power and strategy in general have committed war crimes against civilians in Syria?
Well, I agree with Secretary Kerry that we need to investigate the potential war crimes that have been committed by Russia. They have clearly supported the Assad regime. They have supported attacks against humanitarian convoys. We now see the slaughter of civilian populations in Aleppo. All that has been accommodated because of Russia's support for Assad. In some cases, it's been direct Russian attacks that have caused these atrocities.
All right, Senator Cardin, I'm going to push you on this then. We've got war criminals in Moscow as far as Syria is concerned. We've got threats to NATO and the Baltic states, which are against U.S. policy and the sanctions regime that you've talked about that is absolutely critical to keeping the peace in Eastern Europe. At what point in your mind does this delegitimize this election?
Well, I'm deeply disappointed by the outcome of the election. I don't make any secret about that. It was a free and fair election. Donald Trump was elected according to the Constitution of the United States, and he will be our next president.
So then there's nothing you're going to do. I mean, you're going to poke around and investigate, but there's nothing you could actually do about any of this.
No, I disagree with that. We have our voices. We have our votes in the United States Senate. There's a confirmation process. I've already expressed myself as to what Mr. Trump has to do in regards to his assets. The Constitution is very clear. We don't want to have a constitutional crisis on January 20th. So there are a lot of steps that Mr. Trump must take now before he takes the oath of office. He was supposed to announce what he was going to do with his assets. He's now postponed that till the first of the year. That's going to be a very important announcement. So there's a lot of steps yet to be taken.
I just wonder where your clout is, Senator Cardin. I mean, he's already postponed this. I mean, this is just going to get put into the sort of back burner.
Well, this is not an option. The Constitution of the United States, he takes the oath on January 20th to uphold the Constitution. So it's not an option for the incoming president. He must take action against it. Otherwise, he's in violation of the Constitution.
And therefore, you will begin impeachment proceedings?
No, I did not say that at all. I said we want to avoid that. We want him to take steps to avoid that potential problem. So my only point for raising this is that we are not, he's not yet the president of the United States. He still needs to take certain steps. We expect him to take those steps. But on January 20th, when he takes the oath of office, he'll be held accountable for the Constitution and upholding the Constitution.
He's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Democrat from Maryland, Senator Ben Cardin. Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure. Good to be with you. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. After reports of a ceasefire gave hope to thousands of civilians in the besieged eastern section of Aleppo, Syria, within hours, the fighting resumed and innocent civilians are reportedly not being allowed to leave the Syrian city. A Russian brokered peace deal fell apart last night and Russian air power reportedly went back to work. Samantha Power, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, could not contain her outrage.
Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there literally nothing that can shame you? Is there no act of barbarism against civilians, no execution of a child that gets under your skin, that just creeps you out a little bit?
The accounting and investigation of civilian atrocities in Aleppo promises to tell a grim story of wide international involvement, including that of Russia, as Senator Ben Cardin mentioned just a few moments ago. But for now, the bombs rain down once again. Karim Shaheen is a Middle East reporter for The Guardian, based in Istanbul, Turkey.
The ceasefire seems to be unraveling at this point. The airstrikes have resumed. People on the ground are telling us that the shelling is extremely intense, almost worse than what it was before the ceasefire. The ceasefire, of course, was negotiated to begin last night and was supposed to endure until the rebels and the civilians who are in the besieged districts of Aleppo are evacuated. Unfortunately, the deal was broken. Turks who helped negotiate the agreement with Russia say that the Iranian-backed militias that are fighting alongside the regime of Bashar al-Assad broke the agreement and are objecting to the evacuation of the civilians.
Is that who U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, is talking to at the United Nations, pleading, are you incapable of shame? Is it the militias she's speaking to, or is it someone higher up?
She's speaking to all three major powers that are backing Assad, basically the Syrian government, the Iranian government, and the Russian government. The Russians have obviously been absolutely crucial for the regime's advances due to their deployment of their air power. The Iranian-backed militias have been spearheading the assault for much of the last few months. They were also implicated in potential crimes over the last couple of days by the United Nations, which said one of the militias that originally comes from Iraq had carried out extrajudicial killings and summary executions as they swept through. So the U.S. ambassador was referring to all three collectively. And what we're seeing now on the ground is sort of the fissures and the competing interests in this alliance, because Russia was able to negotiate the ceasefire deal with the Turks without the involvement of the Assad regime and without the involvement of the militias. And it's the militias now that are defying Russia and holding it up.
Well, Karim, these, tweets and internet postings saying goodbye, why can't you help us, world, from inside the rubble are so disheartening and demoralizing to read, even though you have no idea where they're coming from.
They are. They absolutely break your heart. Over the last couple of days, this has been an ongoing feature of the conversations we've been having with the people who are still in East Aleppo. Just last night, after the deal emerged, the news of the ceasefire deal and the evacuation, I received this message from a doctor that I'd been in touch with for a long time, and he was wounded in airstrikes in the past that had targeted his hospital, and he was extremely happy. He was telling me that he's really saddened by the fact that he's going to be leaving Aleppo, but he was heartened by the fact that we might get to meet one day and that they might survive the ongoing massacres. Today, these same people are sending us messages telling us, save us, tell people to stop these massacres. We want to leave. We want to live in peace. And so it's even more heartbreaking now that, once they've made their goodbyes and that they were given hope again that they might be able to leave, those hopes were dashed with the unraveling of the ceasefire agreement.
Speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey, Karim Shaheen is a Middle East reporter for The Guardian. Thanks so much, Karim.
Thank you for having me.
Fossil fuel mess on the prairie, a ruptured oil pipeline in the town of Belfield, North Dakota, the Belfouche, has spilled over 176,000 gallons of oil into the Little Missouri River tributary and a nearby hillside. The spill occurred just 150 miles west of the site where protesters have been fighting construction of that Dakota Access Pipeline. True Companies, the Wyoming-based company regulating this pipeline, has cleanup crews on site. The cause of the incident is still being investigated. We're joined by Lee Patterson, a reporter for Inside Energy. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Lee.
Hi there, John. Thanks for having me.
So is this part of the country crisscrossed with pipelines and that this is one of many?
You know, you have to remember that in the U.S., we have 2.6 million miles of pipelines. So really, every part of the country is crisscrossed with pipelines. And especially in western North Dakota, this town of Belfield is in the Bakken, which is a big region for producing oil and gas.
And as far as when they caught this spill, how much went into the river and how much is on the hillside?
So as you mentioned, rough estimates say around 180,000 gallons of crude oil have spilled. And a lot of that has gone into a nearby creek. Now, once the oil got into that creek, it started flowing downstream towards the Little Missouri River. But according to both the pipeline company and the North Dakota Department of Public Health, that spill is 100% contained, which is important. And in this case, authorities say there is no risk to drinking water. So right now in Belfield, it's a negative two. This cleanup is no small task because of the size of the spill, but also because of the environment. It's freezing. It's snowy. That creek was liquid. It's now frozen, which means some of that crude oil is also frozen. And that just slows down cleanup.
Is this one of the larger spills, or is this, in seasonal terms, the kind of thing that you get year in and year out?
Going back to 2010, say, we average around 200 crude oil spills a year. So that works out to just about one every other day. And Inside Energy found that most of them, 60%, are pretty small, actually 210 gallons or so less. That's, you know, three bathtubs worth. And 5% were about 20,000 gallons or more. So that puts this spill in the top 5% in terms of size.
And what habitats are threatened? Do we know?
Well, it's a good question, and we don't know because that creek is now frozen. But again, the important thing is that there is no risk to drinking water, and that's one of the main concerns when there's a crude oil pipeline spill in a water body rather than on land. In a water body, that oil can move, and it has in the past in a couple of very big, high-profile spills.
And Belfield is not threatened as far as its water supply is concerned. Does True Companies have a good reputation?
It's a Wyoming-based company, and it operates a variety of pipelines. And according to a federal agency that regulates pipelines called PHMSA, that's the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, the subsidiary of the True Companies, the Belfouche Pipeline Company, that's the one that operates this particular pipeline, it has reported 11 crude oil spills since 2010, including five in North Dakota. They've kind of varied in size. None were at water body crossings like this one, and there were no reports of water contamination, but it definitely has a spill record.
So what did the Standing Rock Sioux say in response to this spill?
This was one of their main concerns, that the Dakota Access Pipeline would break and would contaminate their drinking water. And so, you know, of course, the tribe has since posted articles about the spill on its Facebook page. Lots of shares, lots of comments. And I talked to the Standing Rock Sioux chairman, Dave Archambault, last night, and he called this spill a prime example of when leak detection systems fail. He said, "We all know pipelines break." So they are watching this closely.
Lee Patterson is a reporter for Inside Energy. Thanks so much, Lee.
Sure thing, John.
Venezuela's troubled economy gets papered over today, you might say, with a new banknote to deal with a grim inflation rate. Embattled President Nicolas Maduro has set today as the deadline for the last day of circulation of the 100 Bolivar banknote. The president has also closed the border with Colombia in an effort to stop smugglers and gangs from taking those 100 Bolivar notes out of the country. Although why anyone would want to is a mystery. Gangs have been buying the 100 Bolivar note for the equivalent of 2 U.S. cents on the black market and exchanging it for dollars or Colombian pesos. Hannah Dreyer is a Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press in Caracas. This is a pretty serious situation, economically speaking. I mean, since we last spoke, inflation has gone up by serious double digits.
Yeah, I mean, it's total chaos down here right now. There are hundreds of people all over the city waiting to try to deposit their money. That's after people have been taking out banknotes by duffel bags full to try to hoard currency, because before it was really hard to get these bills out of the bank. And yeah, this is the fastest devaluing currency in the world. It's become hard to buy goods and services for cash, essentially.
I mean, what do they do? Just, print these on a, laser jet printer somewhere in the treasury, or do you have to get them from outside of the country?
Yeah, so Venezuela has these terrible shortages, and there are actually shortages of ink and paper here. So no currency can be printed in Venezuela. It's all coming from print shops in other countries. And what's kind of awful is they've been bringing in these plane loads of 100 Bolivar bills, and suddenly those are all going out of commission. Just a couple days ago, I got some 100 Bolivar bills, and they came out in sequential order, like they were brand new with the serial numbers all lined up. And now those bills are all, going to be burned up or recycled.
What do you do when you make a banknote in this situation of inflation desperation? I mean, we're sort of used to money having on the face of it, world leaders. Simon Bolivar himself, a historical figure. Who would you put on the next banknote? That just seems like it would be a kiss of death.
Yeah, I kind of can't overstate how worthless these bills have become. Like, people are using them to decorate Christmas trees this year. At one of my local bars, they hand them out like party favors. Sometimes you see the same 2 Bolivar note just on the sidewalk day after day because nobody wants to pick it up. They're totally useless. And people had wondered if they would put the face of the late President Hugo Chavez on the new bill, because he's like a secular saint down here. But instead, the government probably wisely just put the same people from before on these new bills. So they're taking the 100 Bolivar bill out of commission, and they're putting the same faces on the higher denomination currency. It's just the normal, like, heroes of the independence movement and state birds, stuff like that.
I mean, what does this do to the morale of the country? I mean, we can recall the situation in Germany in the 1920s when hyperinflation brought that country to its knees. And, what happened after that was World War II.
Yeah, the bills, it's kind of an interesting distraction. But the real issue here is the inflation. And that's created huge changes here. The minimum wage is now worth about $15 a month. It just doesn't make sense to work at a lot of these jobs. And so you see a lot of people who are just kind of hanging around, who either aren't going to work or they kind of clock in, but they're not really doing their jobs because they're just being paid so little. Even a professional like a lawyer or a doctor might make $30 a month, and that's not a lot to live on. It's not nearly enough to rent a house and feed a family. So it's just this huge, squandering of productivity. It's really depressing.
Is there a break point here? I mean, does some sort of subsidy have to come in from somewhere to turn things around?
I mean, you keep thinking that you've reached the break point. Like, this week, all of currency basically going out of circulation. The 100 Bolivar bill is basically the only bill people use here. It's what people keep their savings in. A third of Venezuelans don't have a bank account. And so the government's kind of wiping out people's savings. You'd think that people wouldn't stand for it. But instead, people are lining up. They're dealing with it as best they can. There's just a lot of resignation here. And people don't really see an alternative to the current government, even though things have gotten so dysfunctional.
And right across the border in Colombia, where the border is closed partially to contain these 100 Bolivar notes and the smuggling of them, there, of course, is the Colombian situation of civil war that's ending now. Any suggestion that this could become more of an armed struggle if things remain as chaotic as they are now?
Well, there's a hardline element of the opposition here that is always calling for people to take to the streets, to put up not armed resistance, but civil disobedience. The thing is, 2 years ago, there was a huge bloody protest movement here and dozens of young people died and had basically no impact. If anything, the government got stronger and a lot of the leaders of that hardline movement got put in jail. So there are some people who say that they're willing to put their lives on the line to create a change here, but there just isn't that trust among the people that if you do risk getting, say, shot by the police, something really might change.
And there's no coherent political program in the opposition. It's not like socialist or social democrat or liberal conservative. It's just chaos versus what's next.
Right. So there's a couple dozen political parties that have all banded together as the organized opposition. But, I mean, people are as annoyed with them as they are with the government at this point. Yesterday, actually, while all of this bank chaos was happening, the opposition voted to impeach Maduro in Congress. So Congress got together, the lawmakers there said that Maduro was unfit, that he was in dereliction of duty, and nobody cared. Like, nobody paid attention to it. It's not on the front pages of the newspapers today. They're just constantly outmaneuvered by the government, which is creating all of these distractions. And they would say that this currency thing is another distraction.
Hannah Dreyer, Venezuela correspondent for the Associated Press. Extraordinary stuff, Hannah. Thank you so much.
Good to talk with you.
Jawbone Trump calls the robots to order. His skills may have already shown success with the Carrier air conditioning company, but how about the tech industry? Top executives from Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, Elon Musk of Tesla and SpaceX are all expected to face questions from the president-elect about why automation and offshore manufacturing are good for the U.S. economy. They are certainly good for these tech companies' bottom lines. Prominent Silicon Valley venture capitalist Peter Thiel, a vocal Trump supporter, organized this meeting as a way of generating mutual understanding. The group may have been among the hardest campaigners against Trump, though. Does that awkwardness translate into clout? Can Trump charm a group that owes the president-elect nothing and, if anything, is demanding that immigration restrictions for highly educated workers be relaxed? Heather Redman is a startup investor in Seattle, and she says look for this meeting to be more like a polite petting zoo rather than a scrappy place to land punches.
I would expect that on both sides, this is sort of a normalization get-to-know-you meeting. And I think from Trump's standpoint, the win would be he has some very significant folks who are willing to be in the same room as him, notwithstanding their opposition to his candidacy prior to the election.
And as far as policy goes, there's a lot of talk from the Trump transition team about jobs and making sure tech jobs stay in the U.S. But the people who are represented in this group are probably the leaders of industries where jobs are being replaced by robots at a staggeringly rapid rate. And so whether you can hold jobs in the United States, that isn't even the question anymore. It's whether you can hold them to human beings or not.
Yeah, I think you're right on there. I mean, the focus of Trump's attention in terms of job loss has really been on trade-related and globalization-related job loss. And I think if you look at the numbers historically, I think I've heard numbers something like 80% of the job loss has been due to automation, which is really, you know, not sort of globalism dependent. And then I've seen some forecasts, I think, from Boston Consulting Group that going forward, 47% of our existing jobs, you know, full stop, are at serious risk from automation. So what a Trump administration would do about that, I'm not sure. But I think from the tech industry standpoint, it's really up to us to be forward looking and understanding sort of what kind of job landscape that innovation is going to create, and be advocates for educational programs and, you know, sort of meritocracy based programs that would allow people to get those new jobs as those jobs are created. I mean, one of the things that we've been thinking about is say, all right, now we have all these smart homes and all these Internet of Things appliances running around. Is there a new kind of skilled job that would involve being a handyman for smart appliances and smart homes. That's a very different job than being a handyman today, but it's still a real job.
Typically, when business leaders meet with presidents at the White House or in a transition moment like this, there's a regulatory agenda that's top of mind. And I'm wondering if there is a collective notion of regulations that this tech community is really interested in right now. They're mostly pro-climate change, but as far as other regulations are concerned, is there a key relaxation of federal regulations that any of these folks would be interested in?
I think there are a few things. I mean, one that's been top of mind for the tech industry for a long time has been immigration reform. We rely heavily on being able to recruit great talent from all around the world. We also need to obviously support and advocate for better education and better R&D dollars at the federal level as well, just so that we continue to grow our own talent base. But we can't, in our view, cut off the sort of basic meritocracy of having the very best talent attracted to the United States to both work at our companies, but also importantly to start new companies that might fill some of those employment gaps that you and I were talking about a few minutes ago.
What about federal oversight of the internet and the issue of net neutrality?
Yeah, you know, it's been a very hot issue in the tech community. There are some folks who are, you know, providers of the pipes, the telecommunications companies, that would like to be able to charge more for the fast lane, if you will, of the internet. And it's been a principle of most of the tech community, however, to say that we really need everything on the internet to be sort of in the same lane and to have the same rights to speed. And that goes to that sort of free flow of information, which is really a backbone of the sort of meritocratic system that we believe in. If you can't get information on an equal basis and information of all sorts, then you really can't have that free flow of ideas that leads to innovation.
Who's going to speak truth to Trump in this group? I guess if Elon Musk is there, you know, what are the kinds of things that, you know, someone who doesn't have an internal censor and doesn't particularly care that he's the president-elect would say that would be provocative?
You know, I think probably some of the things about cybersecurity may come up. He's very intent on making a material change in the terrorism picture. And one of the avenues that Trump has talked about to do that is to be, you know, more fulsome in the monitoring of communications. And so you recall with the San Bernardino shooting that there was talk about boycotting Apple in order to get them to unlock that particular phone and to basically, in Apple's view, turn over the keys to all security for all Apple products as a result of doing that. And so I think that's going to be an issue that could come up because it's a very one-off sort of transactional issue, and it's the kind of issue that Trump tends to gravitate toward. In this particular meeting, I would be very surprised if anybody tries to take Trump on or if he tries to take the industry on. I should say, with my optimistic hat on, I think this is probably a meet and greet and something that has been engineered by Peter Thiel to try to normalize relations between a lot of folks who have a ton of money and a ton of influence and who have been pretty anti-Trump, to get them to at least, you know, see him as a human being that they can have a dialogue with.
Heather Redman is a tech startup investor in Seattle. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So just a nice, cordial tech meeting there in the Golden Tower in Midtown Manhattan. What tech industry and investment would you pitch to the president-elect?
This is Dee Hayes from Philadelphia. My idea is that we should definitely have mandatory training of all middle and high school students in coding and the utilization of computer hardware funded by tech corporations.
This is Bridget Shea, and I'm calling from Austin, Texas. And I think some of the infrastructure the U.S. should invest in is whatever it takes to support autonomous vehicles and maybe a Hyperloop, but infrastructure for the driverless car instead of the horseless carriage.
Uber's rolling that out in Philadelphia today. From Manchester, New Hampshire, it's absolutely ridiculous that the U.S. has not made significant investments in green energy. We're lagging behind because our policymakers are addicted to fossil fuels. Charlotte, North Carolina, if we want to build a domestic solar industry, give tax incentives and rebates for purchase and installation, and commit to purchase solar for government buildings and installations.
This is Paul calling from Portland, Oregon. I think it would be most productive of them to talk about expanding our digital infrastructure in America. Also, it would seem most timely of them to explore security as well as making the network more accessible and open for people. Two challenges that seem contradictory, but also that in light of espionage, hacking, and the like from China and Russia would be very useful.
Paul, you're so polite. Come on, you can be more feisty than that. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.